From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
Thank you very much, Ollie Barrett. It's a Tuesday's programme, it is. We're just after 5 o'clock, 3 minutes past 5. I am Richie Allen. How you doing? Hope you've had a good Tuesday. It's been very cold here. It's brisk out. Snappy and cold and miserable. But I'm glad that we're here. 5 o'clock's a great time. I've got two brilliant guests for you today. You don't want to miss them. And as usual, if you'd like to tweet the programme, you can do so by tweeting at Richie Allen Show. That's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. What do you say, Kay?
Fabulous.
So good.
It's the Richie Allen Show. Broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Now, we've got a treat in the second hour of the programme. I've connected with a very interesting gentleman called Johnny Cerucci, or Cerucci. Really fascinating man, Johnny. He's been writing books of late about hidden history, secret societies, the Illuminati, the Vatican, the Catholic Church, and, well, they're absolutely fascinating. So he makes his debut on the Richie Allen Show today. Johnny's a former soldier, incidentally. We'll talk about his books and his most recent book in the second hour of the programme today. And I know there'll be huge interest in this. So if there are questions you'd like me to put to Johnny during the conversation, you can tweet them out as we go along. I'm excited about that. Funnily enough, I've been thinking about asking Johnny on for a while. And then earlier in the week, I saw a couple of tweets from people saying, why don't you get Johnny Cerucci on the programme? Yeah, and I've been thinking about it. Great minds think alike, maybe. So look forward to that in hour two. But before that, the brilliant Pippa King is back on the Richie Allen radio show. We usually speak to Pippa about twice a year. Nobody in the UK has done more to raise awareness about the encroaching, the oncoming surveillance state. Pippa first began some years ago down this path when her children's school attempted to get her children to be fingerprinted for a library card system without Pippa's consent and her husband's consent. That's what got her down the road of the surveillance state and Big Brother and all of that. So we're going to talk about facial recognition with her. In fact, I recorded a conversation with Pippa a bit earlier on. She's a busy woman, you see. So we'll hear that in a few minutes' time. All right. Yes. Good. Good, good, good. I've had a community warning from Google about some of the things I said in this morning's newspaper review, which makes me laugh. They haven't forbidden me from uploading or anything. They've just given me a friendly warning about certain things that I said this morning around race and stuff. That's all they said, really. I know what they're talking about, but they didn't highlight, you know, exactly what it was. But anyway, nobody has a sense of humour anymore, you see. Not in the 21st century, anyway. Enough about that. This is interesting because I'm a sports fan. Used to be a fanatic. These days, just a fan. Same thing, Richie? Well, I'm an enthusiast. I like sport. And Israel Folau is a brilliant rugby player. Rugby union, rugby league. He's played rugby league in Australia, but he's known for his exploits with the Wallabies, the rugby union team. He's also known as a Christian, a very devout Christian man. And he's got some opinions that are in alignment with his religious teaching around gay men and women. And he tweeted stuff in that vein. He tweeted stuff last year which saw him being sacked by Australia Rugby, meaning that he missed the World Cup. Bit of a shame, really, because he's a terrific player. They sacked him for homophobic posts. They eventually settled out of court with him when he took umbrage at the fact that he had been fired. He's back in the news, is Israel, because he returns to top-class sport. He'll be playing in the Super League this coming season here in the UK. He's playing for Catalan Dragons, which is a team based in France, which plays in the Super League. We've also got a team in Toronto, which plays in the Super League as they grow rugby league around the world. So he's back and he's joined the Catalan Dragons. What did he say, Israel? Well, he said, hell awaits gay people. That was one of the posts he made last year. I think he's a bit of an idiot. You know, I think anybody who believes that gay people are condemned to a life in eternal flame I think if you believe that, well, you're misguided. I don't buy into any of that. That's me. You know, that's how I feel about it. But if he wants to think that, he should be allowed to think it. Excuse me. Is what I've believed, and you know this, so I don't need to repeat it. So he signed a 1-year deal with the French club and will play for them this forthcoming season. Well, not long after that, we got an announcement by Wigan Warriors that their match against Israel's team, the Catalans, on March 22nd, will be Pride Day. Pride Day. Bit of virtue signalling going on. Rugby league clubs coming out of the woodwork to condemn Israel Folau, who at the end of the day is just a bloke who plays rugby and who goes to church 4 or 5 times a week because he's devoted. So Pride Day, and other rugby league clubs are saying that when they play Catalans, they will rub Israel Folau's nose in it by wearing rainbow colours and all the rest of it. It seems or sounds or looks like a nothing story, but it isn't. It's just more of what's to come in the future. And that is, there will be a homogenous viewpoint for everything. And if you step outside of that, well, we'll make life very difficult for you. We'll condemn you. We'll declare that you're disgusting and you're vile and you're evil and you're wrong and you're terrible and nobody should have anything to do with you. That's where we're going. On that vein, thanks to Jason for reminding me of this today. Thanks, Jason, on Twitter there. John McEnroe, and I like John McEnroe. I've always liked him as a commentator. He is a very colourful commentator, is John. He's joined... Who's he joined? Martina Navratilova. In condemning, again, this comes up every fucking year, a woman called Margaret Court, who's 77. Now, Margaret Court in her time was, well, a bit of a genius of a tennis player. Margaret won 24 Grand Slams. She had to be brilliant. She's 77 now, is Margaret. And one of the main tennis courts, the main tennis court, in the park where the Australian Open is played, is named after Margaret. And every time the Australian Open comes around, there are calls for the stadium to be renamed. Why? Well, because Margaret Court is a homophobic effing bitch, that's why. John McEnroe, whom I thought more highly of, said that Margaret Court is a nightmare for Tennis Australia. She's a nightmare because she's 77 and she's got controversial views on transgender athletes and on gay marriage. McEnroe said there's only one thing longer than the list of Margaret's achievements. That's her list of offensive and homophobic statements. Offensive to who, John? You're not gay, at least as far as we know. So why are you offended, man? This is an Olympic sport, this now, isn't it? Getting offended on behalf of somebody else. Jeez. McEnroe said, Serena, do us all a favour. I'm getting sick, actually, thinking of it. Get 2 more Grand Slams this year and get to 25 to beat the evil Margaret Court. He didn't call her evil. He said, so we can leave Margaret Court and her offensive views in the past. But she won't be in the fucking past. Because even if Serena Williams does overtake her, and it's unlikely, Serena couldn't beat a carpet these days with a fucking banjo, right? Margaret Court's achievements are in history. They'll always be there. She's a church pastor these days. And her views derive from her religious beliefs. I can't find a gay man or a gay woman. I've asked every gay man I know. Does it bother you when Margaret Court and Israel Folau say these things? And generally the question is, coming back, who? Who, Richie? Israel Folau. What did he say? He said that you're going to hell, John. Did he? I couldn't give a shit. That's the way it is, right? Anyway. Margaret Court, 77. She said tennis is full of lesbians. That's just laughable, right? She's 77, goddammit. I told you, very senior people whom I've known in the past have had views that we might feel are antiquated in 2020. But Jesus Christ, they're entitled to them. They are of their age. 13 minutes past the hour. Let's talk about Huawei. Yeah, so Israel Folau will be playing rugby league this season in the UK. And I don't doubt for a minute that the attendances at rugby league grounds are going to increase, because every fucking snowflake in the world is going to adorn themselves in rainbow colours and boo Israel Folau. Boo, boo, hiss, boo, boo, you homophobic bastard, you. I hope he scores 100 fucking tries this season. Stuff it right down their throats. Because I don't agree with him. But he's entitled to his opinion. Now, the United Kingdom has decided to let Huawei continue to be used in its 5G networks. This was announced today. But with restrictions. With restrictions. This has really cheesed off the United States government. Because they've been urging the UK to block Huawei. Now, this is a Chinese firm. You all know Huawei. And it will be banned from supplying kit to sensitive parts of the network known as the core. In addition, it will only be allowed to account for 35% of the kit in a network's periphery, which includes radio masts. And Huawei will be excluded from areas near military bases and nuclear sites. There you are. There you are. So Ed Brewster is the spokesman for Huawei UK. Great name, great name. Ed Brewster. Great DJ name, Ed Brewster. He's the spokesman for Huawei UK. I thought today, actually, it was about time that the UK media got somebody on from Huawei to defend themselves. Sarah Jane Mee asking the questions. She asks Ed about the claims that Huawei's involvement was a security risk because it would enable China to spy on us all. Here's Ed Brewster's response.
Yeah, and I think some of that's driven by, frankly, not a great deal of wide understanding about China. So to answer your question very simply, we're a private company. We're owned by our employees. 96,000 Huawei employees are the only shareholders in Huawei. We were founded by an entrepreneur, a man called Ren Zhengfei, in 1987. And it's been a private enterprise from the beginning and remains a private enterprise today. Our relationship with the Chinese government is no different from any other major company operating in China, be they Chinese or Western.
So what is that relationship?
That relationship is as a private company. So we
do you accept subsidies? Because that's the thing, isn't it? People are saying you're taking subsidies from Beijing to clear up the confusion and to clean up your reputation. You could stop that because you're probably one of the richest companies on earth. You probably don't need these subsidies.
Very good question. Ma on Colleen, as we say, Osqueelga. Ma on Colleen. That's a good question, that. Very good question. Very, very good question. Fair question. Stop taking subsidies from the Chinese government there, Ed. It might alleviate, it might assuage some of these fears, Ed. And he neatly and nicely sidesteps her question.
Today's.
He laughs. He laughs, it's good. He goes, and then let's move on quickly.
Need these subsidies.
Well, what, Ed?
Our success is based on the company's commitment.
I'm just not going to answer it.
To research and development. So last year, we invested over $15 billion into research and development globally. So that's what's giving us a leadership. We're getting no we're getting no subsidies that aren't available to any other Chinese company.
Yeah, but you're still getting subsidies, Ed. You're still getting subsidies. That's the whole point. And not every other Chinese company is helping with the rollout of telecommunications networks in the UK. And Sarah Jane Mee's a very nice person. It shines out of her, actually. You know, for a Sky News presenter, she seems to be a very nice woman. Smart. But she's not hard enough. She should stop him right there and say, look, enough of the bullshit. I don't care about other companies getting subsidies. You get them. So why don't you stop it? And then you can stick your fingers up at your critics in the UK. Which he doesn't interject.
They're very typical. What the subsidies that are accused are effectively tax incentives to invest in R&D. We have, like other companies, received that, like Western companies do in their markets. But the important thing to understand is the success is based upon our founders' commitment of putting at least 10% every year of our revenue into research and development. Our leadership comes from that commitment to long-term innovation. So we're all talking about the launch of 5G now in the UK and across Europe, which is to be celebrated. But Huawei's been...
It's not to be celebrated at all. It's a kill switch, 5G. And it will be for millions of people. I won't get into it now. It's a kill switch. It really is. And then he mentioned 6G. I didn't even think about 6G.
I've been working on 5G technologies and researching 5G technologies for 8 years. You know, there are teams already within the business looking at 6G technologies.
6G. Wow. What do you think 6G will look like? Will any of us be around to even see 6G? I don't know. Right, let's move on from that. At least they got somebody on from Huawei. Lots of news today, which we won't get into. The coronavirus. Yeah. They're not saying anything new. They're just showing us pictures of people's houses being boarded up in China, of streets being blocked off in Wuhan. Right? I'm telling you, nobody will die in the UK or in Europe of coronavirus. And in a few weeks' time, it'll all be forgotten. Prince Andrew's in the news. You heard Ollie at the top of the show. He's being criticised heavily by the lawyers for victims of Jeffrey Epstein because he has done nothing. Since the interview with Newsnight, he has not made himself available. People are cheesed off. Right, Brexit. Friday, 11 o'clock, the withdrawal agreement is triggered. We're out of the European Union. We're not really. We're not, because we go into a transition period then, which means we remain in until the end of the year. Friday. Remainer, or Remoner, Mancunian celebrity, 90s television, 1990s television presenter Terry Christian, was on the Piers Morgan, Susanna Reid shows this morning on GMB. Good morning, Britain. Terry Christian is not happy we're leaving. And he sat there with a Tory Brexiteer, the MP Marc Francoise. Now, Marc Francoise was unsuccessful in lobbying to have Big Ben to chime out triumphantly on Friday night. Terry Christian is not a happy bunny. Here he is in an exchange with Piers Morgan.
3 days ago, you tweeted this, and you then deleted it, for obvious reasons, I would suggest.
No, because said, a friend of mine is...
You said Brexiteers deserve all the job losses and hardship heading their way, and their families. All those tough Christmases ahead with their kids.
Yes, they do.
All their short-term pain.
Yes,
they do. But I will get behind it in future by buying a big issue off the pitiable saps.
Yes.
You deleted that.
Do you know why I deleted it? Because people who sell the big issue aren't pitiable saps. Mm. However, people who, despite all the evidence, have voted to make their own lives and everybody else's harder are. And you'll see that. You're seeing it in Honda shutting down. You're seeing it in the 420,000 jobs that have already gone because of Brexit.
Okay. The trouble is...
And also, we are not leaving. We're not leaving on Friday.
Rather like with Hugh Grant.
We're leaving next year if they can sort something out.
You are a living embodiment of why people voted to leave the
European
Union.
And what's that?
Because
stupidity.
Because they didn't want to spend their lives being lectured by people
I'm not lecturing them. I'm warning them.
You called Brexiteers...
You
called people who voted to leave unread cretins.
Okay. Most of them
Wow.
Yeah, Terry needn't worry too much. The UK is never going to leave the European Union properly. Now, let's talk about facial recognition software. Before we hear from Pippa King, whom I spoke with earlier today, let's hear Silky Carlo. Now, Silky Carlo works with Big Brother Watch. She was on BBC. She was on the politics show, BBC Two, lunchtime today. And she defines, as she sees it, what facial recognition software technology is. This is Silky Carlo.
It's a mass surveillance technology that takes biometric scans of people's faces as they walk past the cameras, which is as sensitive as taking someone's fingerprint. But of course, with surveillance cameras in public places, you're talking about millions of people over time being scanned by these cameras and having very sensitive data being picked up, which we found all over the country through investigations over the last few years. Our estimation is that there is now millions of people in this country who've had their faces scanned by facial recognition cameras, and most of them won't even know about it.
There is signposting, though, isn't there, for the use of these cameras now? The Met has said that they will be letting the public know.
Yes and no. At King's Cross, there was no signposting whatsoever, and it was used there for about 2 years. We found it at shopping centres, museums, places you wouldn't necessarily expect where there's been no signposting whatsoever. And some of the other signposting isn't really very noticeable. By the time you would have seen it, you would have already been scanned. But I think what's really important to say is that what we're seeing now is just the beginning. It's not the end. It won't make any sense operationally to have signposting if the police want to catch the people they say they want to catch, which is a separate conversation. So I think what's going to happen is we're going to see this technology working its way into CCTV networks, and we are going down that road towards a surveillance state.
It's a massive issue, and it isn't being discussed at all on mainstream media. Well, you might say, well, it was today, Richie, briefly, but nobody wants to touch it or the implications. Now, you know who Pippa King is. If you don't, go to pippaking.blogspot.com. She's been writing her blog for, well over a decade. Going back some years, Pippa, as I mentioned earlier on, took on her children's school when they attempted to fingerprint her children without Pippa's consent for a library card system. Since then, she's done some absolutely amazing investigative journalism, you know, reporting on the state of surveillance in this country, how it's being rolled out, by whom, and what the results are for our privacy, our rights to privacy. She's terrific, is Pippa. So I got her on this morning and had to pre-record her, which is a shame because I know you like to interact with her when she's on the programme. But we covered a lot today. I first of all asked her, are we, because again, there isn't any real interest in this, even in the independent media, apart from Pippa, people are not discussing this. I said to her, first of all, I said, are we basically just free-falling into a dystopian Orwellian surveillance state? Here's Pippa King.
I think we are. I think one of the reasons why it is dystopian is because the existing sort of street furniture isn't going to change. It's the technology behind it that's going to change. And the Met Police were sort of trialing it from about 2016 onwards. They had 10 instances where they trialed it at different Notting Hill Festival, Remembrance Sunday, and different shopping centres in London. And in 2018, they actually commissioned the University of Essex to write a report on how brilliant this sort of trial was going. In actual fact, they issued that July 2019 and said that actually there was a highly possible deployment, that the deployment wouldn't satisfy a legal test of human rights if it was contested in a court of law. The actual report was really damning. Independently, it said that, you know, it was 81% inaccurate. And still the Met Police have now sort of finished their trials, in inverted commas, and have gone to deploy it. So even though they know that this is likely to breach Human Rights Act or human rights full stop, they're quite happy to use it.
Why now? Sorry to interrupt you. Why? This is bugging me all morning. If it's not very successful, as you've pointed out, and you've highlighted this on previous programmes, and if there is this big civil rights issue, why do you think they're persevering with it?
The technology at the moment is in its infancy, and I think one of the reasons they've been trialling it, along with South Wales Police, who have actually trialled it 43 times, so they've gone way above what the Met Police has done, is because they're refining the technology, so to speak. And actually, the argument is, well, we shouldn't have it because it's not very accurate. I mean, if it was completely accurate, I'd be more worried about having the technology there. The argument is, should we have the technology at all? If it's going to breach Human Rights Act and privacy, then, and in fact, a judge in South Wales, there was a guy that was at an arms fair in South Wales, a protest against an arms fair, and South Wales Police deployed the facial recognition there, and his face got captured, and he went to Liberty, which is a privacy rights organisation here in the UK, and they actually took South Wales Police to court. And the judgment came through in September 2019 that South Wales Police's use of live facial recognition technology was lawful, but there was definite interference with privacy rights. But under the law legislation we've got, they could do it on a lawful basis. So the Information Commissioner got involved with the Met Police's use and South Wales Police's use of live facial recognition technology, and they sort of said, in the absence of statutory code, that was a problem. There was compliance failures. There was the generic searches they were doing were likely to breach the current Data Protection Act. There was no articulation of how effective it was, questioning the necessity and proportionality of it. But because the judgment came through in Wales that it was basically lawful, the Information Commissioner's Office said, well, because of this ruling, there's no need for us to consider any regulatory action. So from that one lawful basis, and so you've got the Information Commissioner's Office, a judge in Wales saying it's likely to breach privacy, the University of Essex saying it's likely to sort of not meet any human rights standards, the Met Police are still rolling it out. There's been no discussion in Parliament, there's been no advice or anything from the Home Office, and yet it just seems that the police can just roll this technology out without any sort of independent sort of, or anybody in the UK want sort of being able to stop it or at least halt it.
Yeah, just before we carry on that line, Ed Bridges is the case you're referring to. That's on appeal, which will be hugely interesting. He's appealed that decision, which you quite rightly said the decision came down in September, that they were within their rights, the South Wales Police, to film him and capture him. But he's appealed it. Now, when the police are asked about this, they tell the BBC, I'll give you a quote here, in the absence of, we're never going to get the police on here, are we? It's very unlikely anyway. They say, Nick F. Grave, of course, somebody whose name you'll know very well, he said that the police, the Met, has, quote, a duty to use new technologies to keep people safe, adding that research showed the public supported the move. And again, this is my annoyance with the BBC, not to be constantly beating them, but the BBC doesn't refer in any way to the research that he talks about to say that it the public supported the move. I can't find any research that shows we plebs like me, ordinary men and women like me and my family, that we support it. Do people support it, do you think?
I've certainly not come across anything that says that. So, I don't know. I mean, I think it's a very difficult one, really, because I think if you could retrospectively use facial recognition, which police forces all across the UK do, on footage that's been taken from CCTV cameras to say, look for somebody or look for a missing child, and this is what they sort of say. They say, oh, we can use it to look for people with dementia that have wandered off, or we can find a missing child with it. Yes, fair enough, but no instances that they've ever used it for in any trials they've had has been used, as far as I'm aware, in that instance. They've always used it to look for people that have skipped bail. And on one occasion, they were using it to identify people with essentially mental health issues. I remember on Sunday in November 2017, they used the live facial recognition with a set of photographs from their custody suite and the Fixated Threat Assessment Centre, where they sort of collect photos or collect data on people that could be a risk to other people, people that are completely innocent, never committed a crime. And that's what they're sort of using. My worry is that they'll use this technology as a sort of fishing expedition to see who's around, who's hanging out with who. And again, there's no body or there's been no discussion in government to check how the police are using this technology.
And that's a real worry, isn't it? And I want to come on in a moment to the corporate use of it, because, again, the truth is I wouldn't know very much about this if it wasn't for you and what you're doing and reading you and listening to other interviews you do. And I know you've been speaking to a lot of people. I know you had a big speaking engagement yesterday. You've given TED Talks on this. And the freedom of information requests that you make are massively important because of what you glean, what you learn from those. You mentioned how the police use, you know, pull at the heartstrings of people if a child goes missing. I mean, you're a mum, Pippa. I mean, I'm not a parent yet, but I can imagine, you know, dreadful thing. We think, yeah, okay, that sounds good. As you mentioned, an elderly relative with dementia. And they're also talking, I've noticed, in recent days and weeks, about the advent of seriously violent crime on the streets of London. We're hearing every other day about stabbings and machete attacks, and they're using that. And I suppose that's one of the ways maybe they will get public support, you know, because violent crime appears to be, I don't know if it is really genuinely on the rise over recent years, I don't know, but it appears to be on the rise. And I suppose as time goes on, they're going to use these examples as to why we really need this technology. Something I don't understand, you've explained this to me before, so apologies for asking you the same question again. How important is social media to the people who want to use this technology? Are they scouring Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and capturing images of us to cross-reference with their facial recognition software cameras that are out on the street? How does it work?
As far as I'm aware, they're not doing that. They're using their own photographs from custody suites or photographs that have been taken from, you know, things like the Fixated Threat Assessment Centre. But police do use social media and do take data off social media in forms of photographs and all sorts of different things. I'm not sure whether that's used as facial recognition. Maybe. I honestly don't know, but why would they not if they could, you know?
It would make sense, wouldn't it?
And who's overseeing that? Nobody, you know?
Yeah.
So that we don't know. And there's all these questions that need to be asked, you know, really in Parliament. I mean, whether you agree with our political system or not, it's there. And I think we've been so fixated with, obviously, Brexit and other things. Last year in 2019, we were due to have some debate time in the House of Lords on this. We got 1 hour, and the debate time kept putting back and back and back because of other political things that were happening. So we've not had as much movement in Parliament as certainly I and some of the other members of Parliament would have wanted on this, just because other things politically have taken over. And I think because of that, the Met Police, it's been really easy for the Met Police to deploy this because there's been nobody looking at them.
Nobody looking. So let me ask you a question then. Folks, you know who Pippa King is? Hugely important civil rights activist, let's be honest about it, and has done stellar work over the years on biometrics, on surveillance in the UK and beyond, has spoken everywhere about this. Very credible woman. I urge you to go to our website. There'll be details on Twitter later on, and I'll put links on Facebook to the website. So, question for you would be then, playing the devil's advocate, if the police said, right, this is the way it's going to be, we've got a database of mugshots from people that have committed crimes in the past, or people whom we strongly suspect have committed crimes, but we couldn't prosecute them. So in future, all we're going to do is use those photographs to look for people. Or if we believe that a man has committed a very serious crime and he's never been arrested before, we will go to social media and we will try and get an image of that man. We will feed it to our facial recognition software devices, and we will go looking for that man. And we promise that after that search has been completed, every bit of information, every bit of film, every photograph from that particular endeavour will be deleted. Now, some people might say, that's reasonable. What do you say to that scenario? Go ahead.
I think under the Data Protection Act, certainly under the terrorism sort of section of that they would be able to do that. I mean, and police do have to use, I suppose, you know, whatever means necessary to keep us safe. It's just, what do you term necessary? You know, who's deciding what's necessary? I mean, the Extinction Rebellion people got termed as terrorists, and that sort of got taken back, didn't it? So who's making the decisions as to who's terrorising who and what's necessary to do that? And that's where the whole grey area occurs. And then, you know, using tools like facial recognition, at the moment they're only on standalone cameras, sort of on police vans. But if you think of the scenario where that was put behind street CCTV body cams on, you know, that policemen wear, and suddenly you've got a body cam that, but because the technology is there, they've got body cams that can do facial recognition. And if you're talking to a policeman and a little alert goes off saying this person is a person of interest to the police, and suddenly that they've got some more form of information than you've got. And I always think it's really healthy in society for police not to have too much power over citizens, because then we're going down quite a slippery slope. It was interesting. I was listening to a debate on a talk radio show Saturday afternoon, and an 80-year-old Polish woman rang in. They were talking about facial recognition. And she said, you have no idea what it's like to live in an oppressive regime. She was talking about communism in Poland. And she was talking about people that were disappeared, people that were tortured. And she said, if this type of technology was available at that point in time, it would have been game over. There would have been no coming out of that communist sort of era, because the balance of power is so much more skewed. And she was sort of saying, please don't let this technology come in. Or if you do, you've got to look at it and discuss it and have, you know, caps on it and how it's used, who's using it, what for. And I think she made a really good point, because, you know, the government we've got now is relatively benign, and well, so we think. but what if that changes? What if there's a change of thought in the UK and suddenly people like Extinction Rebellion are classed as terrorists? For example, over 30% of the information that goes to prevent comes from schools, data from schools. Who knew that? You know, there's some, the way that this government crunches data and makes decisions is just getting larger and larger. And quite often it's not humans that make those decisions, it's artificial intelligence. So again, we've got all this sort of discussion to have around the use of facial recognition technician, how it's being used, who's making the decisions, who's asking the questions, what do they want from it? And we don't know. We simply don't know. Yet it's now deployed.
Yeah, because my scenario was maybe a bit silly, but it was reasonable enough. But I agree with you because, you know, if you allowed something like this to be rolled out based on this idea that we will look for hard crimes and hard criminals using it, and when that search is ended, we'll delete everybody else's data. Because, yes, we're bound to pick up Pippa King by accident in London or Richie Allen in Manchester, and you shouldn't be on those cameras, so we'll delete them. But, of course, what I was forgetting in asking that question is the definition of crime is changing all the time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, who might be a threat to the state, who might be... more as time goes on, more and more and more and more, we're being told that hate crime is a thing, you know, that which is ultimately thought crime.
Yeah.
You know, that the disliking a group of people. Now, you and I both know it's pretty silly to dislike anybody based on where they came from, where they were born, or who they go to bed with. It's ridiculous. We know that. But increasingly, we're being told that those people who do have these silly ideas are dangerous. So how long before it's a case of, well, we need to really have a photograph of everybody, so that, you know, we can cross-reference those photographs using those artificial... I can understand why that Polish lady said that. It is pretty dreadful. And it is very worrying that you mentioned earlier on with Brexit going on and Huawei and 5G, coronaviruses. This just goes into the BBC and The Independent and The Guardian this week, and there's very little discussion about it. But it's hugely important. And you were doing something very interesting yesterday. You were telling me you were speaking to a group of people. Was it about this specifically, remind me, or was it about, you know, children's data, iPhones and phones? What was it about?
I had a call with the Irish Council for Civil Liberties yesterday. Basically, facial recognition has been introduced into some schools in America, Australia, Sweden, France, and here in the UK, there was a school that trialled it only for two terms. It wasn't very effective. It was in 2010. It was 10 years ago. The technology wasn't mature enough to be used in a school setting. But 10 years down the line, it now is. And there was a parent that rang the Irish Council for Civil Liberties early last week, saying that his child had come home from school, or he'd gone into school, and the school was sort of talking about possibly getting a facial recognition program in, so wow, they could check kids in and out for registration purposes. And so the parent rung the Irish Council for Civil Liberties, and they went to a publication called The Business Post, and there was an article in there. And the school, because of the bad publicity, then decided that they weren't going to run the facial recognition, because actually it didn't seem like such a good idea after the bad publicity. But it's thought that the school's data protection officer went on a sort of an example of, it's got shown by this company, example of how it worked. And although we've no proof of this at the moment, because the school won't disclose who the company is, we think it's a fairly large multinational defence contractor.
Wow.
Which is interesting, because when facial recognition has been introduced in schools in the States or in Sweden or in France, it's generally by startup companies that are sort of just testing the market to see whether there's anything there. So it's slightly worrying if what we think is right, that we've got companies like this now knocking on the education system's door to sell this surveillance type technology.
Imagine that.
I
was just saying, imagine that, defense contractors. And that's why I mentioned corporations earlier on, because whatever we know about what the Met Police is doing here, we don't really know a lot about what private corporations are doing and how they're using it and trialing it. Just on America, before you come back in, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, we know it as MIT, very interesting article, I'm sure you saw it, published there yesterday. 40 influential groups are calling for a moratorium on this technology in the United States. 40 very influential groups. And as I was doing a bit of research before phoning you this morning, Pippa, the Daily Mail is running a story today about the Attorney General in New Jersey, who's an Indian American, I think, a gentleman called Gerber S. Grewal. He's told the state's prosecutors that they must stop using Clearview artificial intelligence private facial recognition software, stop using it immediately, he said, because it's not only compromising the integrity of the investigations in New Jersey, but it's also a gross violation of people's civil liberties. So there's a bit of blowback. Well, not a bit of, there's a bit of a fight back here, which is good.
Absolutely. You know, San Francisco, Oakland, and there's just a bill going through New Hampshire at the moment of banned facial recognition in public spaces used by the police. And also the EU is looking at a possible 5-year moratorium on the technology as well. So despite all that happening, and big tech companies are sort of saying, hang on a minute, you know, everybody's like kids in a candy shop at the moment. We don't quite know what it's being used for. And the adverse publicity and the distrust that will come of misuse of the technology from the public is starting to worry the big tech companies.
Yeah.
So they're sort of saying, hang on a minute, you know, we've invented it, but we don't quite know what you're using it for, because once it's out in the market...
We have a right, Pippa. We have a right to go out and about. I've got a right to meet you next week in London for a cup of coffee without people following us. We have an absolute right to be there in privacy. It's funny this, because people have a weird relationship with being out in the public in privacy. About 3 years ago, I mentioned on the radio show something which I got a lot of criticism for from my listeners, and I was kind of surprised. I didn't mind it, but I was surprised. I was out playing with my dog in Plattfields Park in Fallowfield and throwing a ball for her. She's very athletic, my dog. And I noticed that there was a chap covertly filming me and the dog from behind a tree. And I can be in bad form with the best of them, Pippa. And I was in bad form this particular day. So I approached the lad and I asked him what he was doing. And he said, I'm filming you. And I said, you didn't ask me permission. You didn't ask my permission to do it. And he got a bit defensive. He was a young lad. I think he was a student at the university. And I said, that's out of order. It's bang out of order. You know, I have a right to privacy. You shouldn't be filming me. And I insisted that he deleted the video. And I felt a bit bad later on because I'm a big guy. And I didn't threaten him in any way, but I insisted that he delete the video. And I had a tone of voice that's, you know, kind of put it that way. And later on, I mentioned this on the radio show, just as something to say, how was your day? Would you believe some guy filmed me? And most of my listeners kind of turned on me. They said, that's absolutely outrageous, Richie. They said, there's no such thing as being private in a public space. And I thought, hang on a second.
There is completely.
Yeah.
You know, you don't go out to be filmed. But it's interesting that you said it was a young person. And I think the next generation have grown up with this, you know, surveillance. They were filmed by their parents. If you go into a primary school or a nursery, the teachers are constantly filming the kids to sort of say, you know, what progress they've made. Sometimes when maybe kids hit 13, 14, they go on social media thinking they've not had a digital presence in the world. And suddenly they see their parents. Facebook or Instagram, and their whole life has been recorded. And so for them to go out and film other people maybe doesn't raise as many alarm bells as it should do with us, you know, with us that have grown up with privacy. And this is the problem with this technology, is that we are sleepwalking into a surveillance state, because the next generation doesn't know what it's like to be private or to have the need to be private. And this is what worries me about the technology, with fingerprints, facial recognition, infrared palm scans, iris scans being used in the past in UK schools. It's desensitized the next generation to compliantly giving their biometrics up to a state or a government or a corporation, and they have no idea where that's going to go. I mean, recently, it was only a couple of weeks ago, maybe even a week ago, in China, they use biometrics in schools and in society as part of sort of a control method. But thousands of Chinese students' data got exposed on the internet, and this was facial data and location data, names of parents and mobile phone data. And in a 10-day period, 1.3 million pieces of data appear to have been gathered from that. And that's astounding. And if you could imagine if that happened, say, in the UK, and the Department of Education has, it was only recently, the learner record database that they have got compromised by a third party who was accessing it for, I think it was a gambling company, to see if people were over the age of 18 or could gamble. And that's a use of data that the Department of Education didn't realise it was being used for. Certainly parents who give that data to schools don't realise it's going to be used for that. So this is this sort of willy-nilly taking of data, and really nobody looking at how it's being used or crunched, or, like I said, the questions that's being asked and the data that's being gleaned from it, assumptions that's being gleaned from it. we need to be really careful. So I welcome any sort of ban or moratorium on facial recognition, because it does give us that opportunity to have that conversation, hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully it's right. Back in August, when you were last on the programme, you talked to us about freedom of information requests that you'd submitted to councils in Scotland, I think Glasgow being one of them, because you kind of shocked me at the time. You talked about the over 100,000 iPads being made available for students there, which I thought was just amazing. And I wasn't wholly surprised, because over the years we've talked about how these tools are going to be used in education in the future, maybe in the future, maybe in the near future, there won't even be any need for a teacher to be in a classroom. Everything will be fed through the device, maybe, or maybe I'm wrong. We'll see how it goes. But that particular, I won't say campaign, but investigation that you're undertaking at the moment is very relevant, is very pertinent, because you asked some very, very important questions about when the child uses the iPad given to them by the state school at home, how do people know who's doing the homework, who's doing the work. But you also quite rightly point out that all of these new devices are coming with fingerprint capabilities to open apps and to secure the device, but also they've got bloody cameras front and back, fore and aft. And who's to say that those iPads cameras couldn't be used to, to run programs to scan the faces of children to determine how the children are feeling, how they're getting on, or how they're doing. Are they paying attention in the classrooms? So that campaign of yours to get information about that in Scotland is very relevant to facial recognition. How's it going, that? What have you learned?
Well, at the moment, I've got freedom of information requests in with Glasgow, Edinburgh and the Scottish Borders, only because the iPads haven't really been, they were rolled out sort of last term. So basically what's happened in Glasgow, Edinburgh and the Scottish Borders, there's a Canadian company called CGI, which have got the contracts to run basically all the IT in those three authorities. And within that contract is sort of replacing the IT in school, so upgrading all their whiteboards. And they decided to go in Glasgow and the Scottish Borders for completely Apple product. And part of the contract these are multi-million pound contracts that last for years, is that the school populations in the Glasgow and the Scottish Borders and part of the school population in Edinburgh get issued with iPads. So basically, they're all iPads. So every student from 11 to 17 will have an iPad, and the students in primary will be sharing maybe one iPad to five students. And this is going into nursery school, so if you could have 3 or 4-year-olds using iPads. Now, apart from all the health dangers of having a Wi-Fi device sat in your lap, or the damage that blue light can do to your eyes, and actually looking at a screen turns off certain parts of your brain. So putting all that argument to one side, I'm sort of purely looking at the data scrape that can be done. So this Apple iPad project is the largest project globally to be given to schools in this sort of nature. So Scotland's school population is running about 700,000, and we've got nearly 120,000 iPads going out. So that's a very large proportion of that Scottish school population having iPads. So it's not, and it is a absolutely huge opportunity for Apple and CGI and also Scotland, the Scottish Education Department, to sort of see how the use of iPads is being used with children in schools and also out of school, because they don't, they're available 24/7. So these iPads will have portals, so the only way the child can use them is if they sort of log on via the school system. So they won't have access to social media, for example, but all the apps that are on the iPads are completely controlled by Glasgow, Edinburgh, Scottish Borders. I'm not saying that CGI or Apple will be taking any data from these iPads, but you don't gift or write that sort of technology rollout into a contract unless there's some kickback for the companies that are doing it.
Absolutely.
And so my main focus then is looking at how the data is used, but also as well, they did this in San Francisco, I think in 2014 2015, a company there gifted, just like these are being gifted, 3,000 iPads to a school district over there. And as it turned out, which they didn't tell the pupils or parents at the time, is that every 60 seconds through the camera on the iPad, their faces were getting scanned, because they wanted to know who was reading the book, who was doing the maths homework. So, for example, the speed at which you turn pages on an electronic book, or areas of math, say, for example, on multiplication, that you spend more time on, these apps will take all that information. So a very detailed profile can be gained on how a student learns. So, you know, if you're not very good at something, and I'm sure we would have done this, and we might have back in our day, you could tell if somebody had done your homework for you because it was in a different handwriting, and teachers could see that. Can't see that on an iPad. So if you've got a particularly difficult project, you're not telling me some kids aren't going to say to their best mate, can you just do this part of my maths homework for me? And then you start to get what's corrupted data, which is as worrying as data that's pure, because then sort of going back to the use of artificial intelligence, which they do have in schools, and they do use artificial intelligence to predict how children are going to do, then you've now got an inaccurate assumption of a child. And when you've got that sort of, so the sort of logical progression that I can see would happen with these iPads, I'm not saying it will, and this is one of the things I want to find out, is that there will be some sort of biometric control sort of every 60 seconds or so to check that, you know, whoever's in front of the iPad is, it should be the person who's meant to be doing the homework, because otherwise you're going to get a very inaccurate education data system going on there, which actually is worse than having a sort of an accurate one in some senses. So I've got freedom of information requests in with the councils to sort of ask who's looking at the apps, how are you going to make sure that children are doing their own homework, sort of thing. But I think it's interesting because there are quite a few articles that have come out recently about people in Silicon Valley and a lot of private schools, Steiner schools, moving right away from any screens, iPads, computers in schools, even whiteboards, because actually the students don't learn. There's an argument to say they don't learn as well. And certainly the type of engagement they have in the lesson is different when they've got a screen in front of them as to when there's no screens at all. So it's, again, another experiment on UK school children to see what's going to happen with this. I mean, it could be an amazing opportunity, but absolutely the amount of data that could be scraped is off the scale with something like this. And they're kids, and they shouldn't have to worry about that. And I don't see anybody else worrying about it. So I'm sure there might be some other people, but certainly I'm worrying about it. So that's a sort of ongoing situation at the moment. But the iPad rollout is to be sort of finished by 2021 to the students. So middle of last year, the teachers, about 5,000 iPads went out to different teachers so they could get used to the apps. And then the sort of iPad rollout sort of started October last year. So this is a sort of an emerging thing. And it would be interesting to see, you know, what the school results are now as opposed to what they're going to be like in 5 years' time. Because I'm sort of assuming that, you know, kids are kids and they'll just learn regardless of what they've got in front of them. I mean, there might be some instances where iPads are really useful for certain things, but I can't see the standard of education leaping up personally, because it hasn't done anywhere else in the world with the use of this technology. No. So I don't know why it would do in Scotland.
Yeah, and of course, again, if I put my conspiratorial hat on me, it's easier to target, you know, a person or a group of persons with a certain type of, I don't want to say propaganda, but with a certain narrative. It's easier to do that if you get them addicted to the tech. And we know this is from official sources. The technology is highly, highly addictive.
And absolutely,
isn't it? And when it is, and you've got them on that screen, it's much easier to give them a version of anything. It could be nature, it could be geometry, it could be the solar system, but you give them a version. And they're not getting lots and lots of different bits of information from different sources. And that's a problem for me. And of course, the huge problem which you've identified time and again, Pippa, through your activism and writing, is the lack of consultation, the lack of genuine saying to parents, say, listen, what do you think about us doing this? I mean, again, this is an issue for another day, you know, about who's looking after children. Mm. Who's responsible for children? The parents who bring them up, who gave life to the children, or the state? And that's that segues into that as well. It's massive, this, and it's tragic that, apart from a bit of BBC, bit of Guardian, bit of Independent this week, you know, it just kind of rolls on. But I think you're doing an amazing job, and I can't wait to find out what the authorities in Glasgow say to you when they get back to you, because I looked at the questions you've asked them, brilliantly detailed questions, and hopefully you'll find out right soon.
Yeah, it would be interesting. And I'm also waiting to hear about bio freedom of information requests to the Irish Education Board to see what company it is that's sort of targeting what we think is quite a hefty amount of Irish secondary schools. And the reason why I'm sort of looking at Ireland, I mean, that the data protection and bills are very different to ours, but they still come under GDPR, which is the General Data Protection Regulations, the European ones that came in 2018. And but in Northern Ireland and Scotland, which is why I'm particularly looking at the Scottish iPad rollout, we have a Protection of Freedoms Act, which protects the use of children's biometrics in schools, in the fact that children need to give their consent and both parents need to consent, and nobody needs not to consent, otherwise the school can't process a fingerprint. But that only applies to children in England and Wales. So I'm working with a Scottish MSP, because at the moment they've got a biometrics commissioner role that's going through the Scottish Parliament. So we have a biometrics commissioner for England and Wales, and Scotland doesn't have one, and actually it should, because the Scottish police use of biometrics is coming on in at a pace much like it is in the UK, in England, and also you've got, you know, biometrics in schools being used. So we're trying to get the remit of that biometrics commissioner to cover the use of biometrics in schools, because the one in England and Wales doesn't. So again, there's nobody looking at how schools are processing children's biometrics, who's supplying the information and the technology to do it. Because, I mean, it's essentially, when fingerprinting in schools first happened in, well, actually 1999, so we've had it for 21 years now, this particular school, sorry, I'm just going to have a little sip of water, hang on.
Yeah, go ahead, yeah. Everybody's got the lorgy, yeah, we've all got it.
The school where my two children were at primary school, that nearly fingerprinted them, the technology they were using was from a company called Digital Persona, and it was old, outdated fingerprint technology that we used in Guantanamo Bay. So it is this. It's obviously this technology is coming from the military, but it's completely unnecessary for schools to have this level of data collection in order to educate a child. Absolutely. My goodness, how did we survive 30
how
years?
How did we survive, me and you? Hey, listen, remind us before we go. I mean, I'm going to put links out, as I always do anyway. Mm-hmm. You get a lot of hits on your site. But remind our listeners, where's the best place to find you these days?
So I have a website called pippaking.blogspot.com, which actually I'm in the process of updating. So I have another one called biometricsinschools.com, which literally looks at sort of the use of biometrics in technology and data in schools. Then I have another one called stateofsurveillance.com, which touches on the police use of facial recognition technology, their use of infrared technology, millimeter microwave technology, so they can scan you to see if you're wearing weapons and all this sort of thing. So it's facial recognition is one piece of armory that the police have got in a whole emerging sort of sea of technicians that are available to them now, again, from military sources.
From the military.
So, and I'm also at Pippa King on Twitter. You'll be able to find me.
And next time we chat, we'll talk about the implications of 5G technology for the capabilities that they want, because we didn't touch on that so much today. I've been getting into it quite a bit of late, but that's also hugely important as well. Just to say, as usual, thanks for giving us your time. I think, I know I don't say this for the sake of saying it, but we're lucky to have people like you, because it's not easy. It's time consuming. It's a hassle. It's a pain in the arse dealing with local authorities. You're remarkable in the way that you go about it. You're a proper professional. The courtesy, I read these requests, your courtesy and professionalism in dealing with these people to extract information from them is a bit of a lesson. And if you weren't doing it, there wouldn't be anybody else doing it. So sincere thanks for that. And parents need to pay more attention to people like you. Thanks, Pippa.
That's okay. Thank you for having me on, Richie. It's been great.
Pippa King on the Richie Allen Radio Show today, Tuesday, January 28, 2020. That's hugely important. And thousands of iPads being rolled out and given to school children in Scotland. You know, there is a payoff. The people behind that so-called or, you know, seemingly benevolent decision to do that, what's the payoff for them? It's the surveillance of the children. It's studying the child. It's programming the child, monitoring it, and ultimately learning how to better shape the child the way they want to shape the child. It's huge. It really is. And there isn't anybody talking about it. It's not been spoken about enough. PippaKing.blogspot.com is the website where you'll find more about Pippa King. We're approaching 2 minutes past the hour. This is the Richie Allen Radio Show. We'll be crossing the pond to Philadelphia real soon to chat with Johnny Cerucci. But before we do that, we're going to take headlines as we approach 2.5 minutes past the hour. Can we get headlines going here? Can we? We mightn't be able to. Can we? We can. We can get headlines. Right, headlines. Ollie Barrett, FSN, back in 30 seconds.
From Feature Story News in London, I'm Ollie Barrett. The UK has decided to allow Chinese firm Huawei to have a limited role in the build-out of Britain's 5G network. Hong Kong says it will slash travel to and from China because of the coronavirus outbreak. Over 100 fatalities have now been confirmed in China. And a lawyer representing women who claim they were abused by Jeffrey Epstein has urged Prince Andrew to cooperate with an investigation into the disgraced financier.
Thanks very much, Ollie Barrett. Right, Johnny Cerucci will be on the programme in a couple of minutes' time. Just anything you want to put to him, tweet it to me through Twitter. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. Really fascinating man, great backstory. And he's written some, well, incredibly interesting books in recent years. We'll talk to him about those, and I know he'll be participating, as I said, through social media. So I look forward to that. Very quick break.
Renowned healer Mark Byerski travels the world to find the most unique and powerful crystals for self-healing. Since the ancient times, crystals have been used as healing tools. They hold a natural healing vibration and are highly charged in positive energy. Mark teaches how to channel the universal energy and transfer it to the crystal to activate its healing power. Each crystal is used for its unique ability to target a different physical or emotional challenge. Mark Byerski is an author, healer, speaker, and founder of the Pure Energy Healing Academy. He shares powerful messages of inspiration and healing on his daily YouTube videos, reaching millions worldwide. Mark's crystals, healing oils, and incense sticks are most sought after by other healers. His collection is available online at www.markbyerski.com. His work is presented through Lemon House, a company that creates and curates consciously made gifts.
Music from Stevie Wonder on your Richie Allen Show. Johnny Cerucci is next. This is brilliant. Good to be with you this Tuesday. Stevie Wonder on the Richie Allen Radio Show for once in my life. Coming up for 7 minutes past the hour. Broadcasting live from Salford in Greater Manchester. Multiple platforms, richieallen.co.uk. We're on the TuneIn or radio app as well, triggerwarning.tv. And I'm really excited about meeting my next guest, and he's going to stay with me pretty much up to the top of the hour. I don't think it'll be the only time we talk to him. This is interesting stuff, this. I have become increasingly interested in this area of research in recent years. It's a funny thing, I don't know, this paradigm. It's a funny thing. I've been looking at him for a few weeks and liking a lot of what he's been doing. And I thought I must give him a shout and, you know, shout him up and ask him to come on the programme. And as I was doing that, I received a couple of tweets from people saying to me, Richie, you should get this gentleman on your programme. So don't believe that telepathy isn't a thing. It must be a thing. How do you explain that otherwise? Now, let me tell you a little bit about him. I won't waste too much time introducing him because time is short and I know you want to hear from him. You don't want to hear from me. Fascinating man. He's an Iraq war veteran and it seems that his experiences in Iraq have certainly shaped what's happened to him in the last 15 to 20 years. What he saw there, what he witnessed, the energy there, the things he saw, the things he did, maybe not what he did, but what he saw being done to the Iraqi people, but also to US soldiers there and soldiers from around the world. It definitely profoundly changed him. As I said, I've been reading all about him and listening to his podcast as well. And he began to think that, well, things are not right. Things are not run. That maybe the people we put our faith in, our governments, our military, our police, our authorities, maybe they're not looking out for us. Maybe they're the real enemies. And maybe that's, you know, not doing a great service to what it is that he began to feel and think. He'll tell us himself in a minute. He's got a podcast called Resistance Rising, the Resistance Rising podcast. Very, very interesting it is. I'll put links on Twitter to where you can find that. But more importantly than that, he's written a series of books. He's got a brand new book out. Books called Secret History, Eaters of Children, Illuminati Unmasked, and his most recent book, Romans of Mass Destruction, Volume 1. You can find out more about him on his website, johnnycerucci.com. It's a real pleasure from Philadelphia to welcome Johnny Cerucci to our programme. Johnny, welcome to the programme. I hope I'm pronouncing your surname properly.
It is, Richie. I have arrived. I can't believe I'm finally being interviewed by the BBG. I can't tell you how excited I am.
You're a gentleman. Thanks for saying that. Not at all. It's about bloody time you were on the programme. Because these are things that are fascinating to me. They're fascinating for our listeners. We've got to move beyond the five senses. We've got to move beyond mainstream news and news programming and start to accept that nothing is coincidental. And you know, can I start with that, Johnny? Because when you're in Iraq, serving your country as you set out to do, it's a noble thing to do. You know, you think, my country is in trouble, we're being attacked, I'm going to sign up, there's nothing wrong with that. And you begin to think that, well, there's something very wrong here. And somewhere along the line, I'm guessing, you begin to think, there are no coincidences. We keep putting these things down to bad policy decisions, to bad planning, to mistakes by our military. But somewhere along the line, we've got to start to think, is there an overarching plan here? Is there some hidden plan, some secret agenda for humanity? And I'd like to start with that. Did that begin for you, for sure, after you returned back to the US from Iraq?
It did, Richie. You know, I was born and raised Italian, Roman Catholic, very passionately conservative, pro-American patriot. I still am. But that was what motivated me to get into the Marine Corps. And then I did some time in the Marine Corps, and I got out to go into college and wanted to stay and become an officer. And the Marine Corps kind of pushed me aside. So I went in active reserve in the Marine Corps. And then 9/11 came around. I called the Corps back up. I said, hey, you guys need me, right? We're in a war. And they're like, actually, no, we really don't need you. I was like, what, are you kidding me? So I made my jump with my college degree to become an Army officer, and that led me up into my time in Iraq. And it was upsetting for me. It was disturbing for me. I did spend a considerable amount of time outside the wire, outside the green zone, as they say, and it just seemed like everything we were doing was counterproductive, Richie, and the infrastructure. Iraq was a chaotic mess, and it shouldn't have been. The electricity, the water, the septic, the sewage, you know, it's driving by, kids playing on mountains of garbage, just deeply, deeply upsetting. And then reading about, I wasn't part of the security, but reading about, oh, pallets of money being brought in and given only to the selected elite that are out there. Meanwhile, the average citizen is miserable and in more trouble, less secure than they ever were before the incident. And I came home and it just had shaken me up. I spent a year ripped from my family, and I didn't feel any better coming home. And then I come home and I go through the airport, and people in the airport are holding their arms up like they're in a prisoner of war camp being scanned by a naked body scanner, and the government's telling them, hey, don't worry, when we take these images of your little girl and your little boy, we're not saving them, trust us. Meanwhile, they're building these mega complexes to store billions and billions of bits of information. And I'm thinking, this isn't getting better, it's getting worse. Then I'd start doing some of my own digging, and I see that the director of the Central Intelligence, guys like John O'Brennan, they're calling him the drone executioner because he seems to be randomly droning any marriage wedding ceremony that comes along. He's creating more jihadis than he's killing. And so I tell you, Richie, also through the process, through the training process, it seems like I was being indoctrinated more on not telling sexist jokes than I was discerning what an IED looked like as I was driving past it.
Is that right?
And it really was, I'm like, what side are you guys on? The rules of engagement were outrageous. When I was there, I was told that I had to work hand in hand with local Iraqi police and military. And they usually were not up to par. And so it was just an absolute mess. And I was still in the service, but I was stateside in 2011 during the Barack Obama administration. Now, before that, I was still deeply connected to so-called conservative media, the conservative talking heads on radio and television. And the advent of Barack Obama really kind of frustrated me. I knew that there was something more about that guy, and yet the conservative talking heads were pulling their punches on him. They weren't digging into his past. And I was, if I wanted to learn more about him, I'm obviously not going to go to you guys. I might as well go to the mainstream media. You're carrying water for the system. And there seems to be no difference between Bush, Clinton, Bush, Obama, Trump. It's all the same policies. There's no change in the policies. I tell people ruefully now that Donald Trump is going to close the border treasonously wide. No country in the world has their borders wide open for decades upon decades. Any threat can waltz across the border and does. There was a rapist in the 80s and 90s named Resendez Ramirez, who would bounce from state to state on a train, raping and murdering at will. He would get collected by immigration and naturalization. They'd hold him for a couple hours and kick him back out to do some more rapes and murders. Absolute treason. And I've told people Donald Trump is going to close the borders as fast as Barack Obama closed Guantanamo Bay. And here's what I found about Guantanamo Bay as I looked up into it. Guantanamo Bay is in the heart of our enemy, our supposed communist enemy, Cuba. Why does the United States Navy, secured by the United States Marine Corps, have a black site holding facility outside continental United States? It's to do things that are illegal in the continental United States. The purpose of Guantanamo Bay is to create more jihadis. It's not to solve, it's not to make us safer. It's to take innocent Arab Middle Easterners and destroy them and then kick them back out after they've been destroyed to make sure they perpetuate the so-called war on terror. Why is it a war on terror? Because it's going to have no end.
This is
huge.
This is massively interesting to our listeners. Now, I wanted to take you back to something you just said. Gianni Johnny Cerucci is live on the radio show from Philadelphia. I'm so glad you're here today, Johnny. Now, when you came back, you were disturbed, understandably, hurt by what had happened and what you'd seen. Now, you talked about conservative media, and you would have leaned towards conservative media for your news, and that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. I would have leaned in the past. I would have leaned towards lefty media sources. I've learned some of the same lessons you have. Now, were you also disturbed when you returned home to the States to see that the conservative media wasn't reporting on the lunacy that you experienced with your own eyes, that you witnessed, that you bore witness to when you were in Iraq? Was that a real problem for you as well when you got
absolutely
back?
Absolutely. All the fraudulent reasons for the war, the yellow cake, nuclear weapons, weapons of mass destruction. You yourself, I actually, after you read that Salon.com article on how the United States went to war. I never say we, Richie. I'm we. An average citizen is we.
Yeah.
The United States government illegally went to war in Libya based on lies and fabricated intelligence to create chaos in Libya. Now, that Richie, God bless you. God bless your audience. You question things. We don't just take it in. And this is what I learned the hard way through my bad experiences. Stop trusting the government. Stop trusting my chain of command. Stop trusting the media. Shockingly enough, the media seems to be in league with the government in not reporting what needs to be reporting and telling lies and giving cover-ups. There was no reason to destroy Libya in chaos other than to have access to the tier one and tier two weapons that were the focus of the Benghazi debacle. It's a debacle to good citizens. It wasn't went exactly as planned to the CIA.
Yeah.
The purpose of Benghazi was a way station where they were handing out weapons like the SA-7 Grail surface-to-air missile to CIA-enabled jihadis. The more I look, the more I research, both my personal experience and my research as an independent investigative journalist, there's no such thing as jihad, Rich. There's no such thing as jihad. They are completely fabricated. was it Greenwald? Glenn Greenwald? It's hilarious because ruefully hilarious. I think he was talking about domestic terrorism. And he said something like, whenever you find a cell of three domestic terrorists, two of them are FBI agents. Well, that's the same thing for jihad. Wherever you find one lunatic jihadi, they're surrounded by 10 CIA agents. There's no such thing as jihad. It's completely fabricated and enabled by Western intelligence. These people have a vested interest in chaos, in money-making, and much more upsetting, Richie, in trafficking of narcotics and trafficking in human beings. The real traffickers are governments. And above them, that's what I found out when I researched Illuminati Unmasked. Above them, believe it or not, is the Vatican.
Is the Vatican. Well, and we're definitely going to come to that. And we're going to go to the top of the hour. I know we're going to do another show in a few weeks on this. We're going to do a series with you because I really like, I've been reading some of your book online. You get to read a little bit of the book. The books, if you go to Amazon, if you go to johnnycerucci.com, you'll find links to Johnny's books. We're talking to an Iraq war veteran, an officer who spilled the beans on what he saw in Iraq, came home from that, changed his life. He began to look at why. Why are these things happening? Why are these insane things happening? Who's behind it? And what's the end game? And these are the things he discusses on his podcast and that he writes about as well in articles on his website and, of course, in the books. Hugely important. Great friend of mine has just sent me a message to say, Johnny's right, the media is in league, as we know, from Rockefeller's 1981 address to the Council on Foreign Relations. She's absolutely right. Now tell me this, what you've just told me, would this be widely known amongst returning veterans? Would returning veterans, speaking amongst themselves, would they know what you just told me, the trafficking of human beings, the narcotics trafficking, and the fact that where you find a jihadi, you'll find a CIA guy, maybe you'll find an MI6 guy, maybe you'll find a Mossad guy, giving him whatever he needs to go and cause carnage. Do veterans intrinsically understand this, Johnny?
Richie, veterans and law enforcement officers, all of them have a nagging doubt. All of them have a little voice in the back of their head saying, fuck, that's not right.
Yeah.
What we just did, that's not right. And what they do, Richie, is they go through a process. They are trained to shut up. Shut up. You want to advance? Shut up and go with what you're told. You will advance if you shut up and carry on. Pretend that never happened. Look the other way and keep going. And if they don't look any deeper, then they're not really exposed to the disgusting, despicable, gory details, particularly of the human trafficking, of all the victimization and the outrage and the anguish of that, because they want to feed their family, they want to advance. And so I got to the point, Richie, where I knew anybody above E6 in the U.S. military, particularly on the land side of the house, E6 is staff sergeant above, anybody really above captain, major, particularly Fulberg, Colonel 06 and above general, all kept in control, thoroughly kept in control. I came across some old interviews. They're still floating out there of a woman named Kay Griggs. Oh, just eye-opening about the sexual perversion and deviancy that is the inside blackmail and dope. And you wonder why Hollywood keeps pushing this myth and the mythos of the great Spartans. Well, because there was a subculture, particularly in Sparta, of sexual deviancy and homosexuality that compromised the ethics and the morality of the soldiers, and they promote that. They want the real hardcore soldiers at the very top to be compromised, to have their ethics compromised, to be frustrated. And this is for law enforcement too. They're frustrated because their own chain of command won't let them do their duty, won't let them nab the criminals, won't let them get the bad guys. So then they give them an outlet that is totally controlled and said, you got to break the law to go do your job. Then they find out, shit, I broke the law and killed the wrong guy. Too late. You belong to me now. You're going to do what I tell you. You're on the team, or we're going to leak this how you did the dirt. And that's how it works, Richie. So the vast majority of soldiers and police, law enforcement officers, they have that nagging voice in their head. And honestly, I thank God that I had a shitty career. I thank God that I had a shitty career because that helped me to ask questions. I was pigeonholed. I should have made major. I never made it past captain. And I was basically kind of forced out. I got an honorable discharge, but they kept me in a holding pattern where I could not get promoted. And that kind of, I never really did what I wanted to do anyway in the military. And all those bad experiences helped me feed that nagging voice. If I had been promoted, if I had been getting the cheese, it was handed to me, I probably would have done what all the other, I don't know, I'll say probably, the other side of this, Richie, is compassion. If you have normal human compassion, maybe a little bit more so, I'm an emotional Italian, I go over there and I see an old man holding his grandson by the hand on the side of the road, and I got to walk up to that little boy and give him a piece of candy and kiss him on his forehead, and they both look at me like I'm a superhero, man. That gives me chills. I got the hair on my arm standing up. You go through that, and it's going to affect you. If you have compassion for the average person, that's going to tell you stop. You cannot turn your head. You cannot, for your own personal advancement, do what is best in your interest, because it's unethical. And it's wrong, and it's going to hurt innocent people. And those things have a chance of waking up the rank and file. And that's why when you come back, the Veterans Administration questions you diligently. Hey, you feel depressed? Do you drink? Do you smoke? Do you do drugs? Oh, you can't have guns then. You can't have a privately owned firearm. We're going to keep an eye on you. You're going to come to counseling. They are dangerous, especially the ones like me that you know, didn't get their advancement. So the average soldier and the average police officer, man, this is the revolution is waiting to happen, but it's going to happen from the inside. And it has to happen from people who hold the guns. You're not allowed as a private citizen. You're thoroughly outnumbered and overwhelmed. It's not up to you. It's up to the ones on the inside to listen to that little voice in their conscience that repeatedly tells them there's something not right there. So that's to answer your question. Yes, all of the soldiers, Marines, airmen, law enforcement officers, they have that nagging voice. Now, whether or not they listen and dig deeper, the vast majority, unfortunately, don't, because they have a vested interest. They have a system, a culture that tells them, don't look any deeper, shut up, turn around, salute, walk off.
And self-preservation and families back home and everything else. I totally understand that. Johnny Cerucci is our guest, live from Philadelphia, city of brotherly love, 27 minutes past the hour. The Richie Allen Radio Show. We're going to talk about the Vatican in a few minutes' time. Before we get there, though, to those listening with a sceptical ear, who don't believe you, they're saying, why is all that going on? Why is in these disaster zones like Libya, like Afghanistan, like Iraq, how and why is the CIA and other intelligence agencies, why are they trafficking drugs and why are they trafficking children? Now, Johnny, I first of all have got to put my cards on the table. I believe you're right. But for those who don't and think, hang on, Richie, you're giving Johnny an easy time of it here. Why would they be doing that? What's in it for any intelligence agency in the Middle East to be trafficking in children on the scale that you believe it's going on? Why?
Richie, the amount of wealth involved is inhuman. It's shocking. It's absolutely shocking. For the purpose of making money, wars. I mean, United States Marine Corps General Smedley Butler said himself, war is a racket. War is a money-making machine that you can do things. And let me tell you something else. Not only can you make money in war that you can't ever make in another circumstance, you can also use the Hegelian dialectic, problem, reaction, solution, to yank a free society into a police state that they would never go to otherwise. You present them with these boogeyman threats and tell them, we're now going to fill London with 500,000 closed circuit TV cameras. You need them to be safe. Trust me.
Yeah.
We're now going to, I'm going to bring back the armored MRAPs that I drove. I rode in as a soldier in Iraq. We're going to give them to local law enforcement. Anytime a mass shooting occurs, and they're occurring once every 2 weeks now here in the United States. Lunacy. We're going to take police officers and turn them into a standing military. We're going to gun them up like they're retaking Fallujah. We're going to fill them with, we're going to have them put down their blue uniforms and badges and don literal camouflage, body armor, and assault, fully automatic assault weapons. The assault weapons that they say I can own, but I can't own. We're going to have them ride in military vehicles, and we're going to train the citizenry that it's all for their safety. the money, first and foremost. Second of all, let me throw in the Kennedy assassination real quick as a partial answer to this. Does anybody in your audience really believe that Lee Harvey Oswald killed John F. Kennedy? Come on, back into the left. Back into the left means that there was the kill shot came to the, from the front and to the right. Poor Jack Kennedy said the back of his head, the Zapruder film, the back of his head blew completely off. There was the kill shot. There were multiple. There was a team of assassins. All right, so you step back. Oliver Stone's JFK was basically a documentary, very well done movie, basically a documentary. So if you now put Lee Oswald aside, Lee Oswald, the United States Marine who was stationed in Okinawa, who freely went to the Soviet Union, married the daughter of a Soviet Army intelligence colonel, and came back to the United States without a hitch.
Yeah.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah, yeah.
Are you kidding me? Okay. So this is the guy that from 200 yards away with an antiquated, was it like 100-year-old Carcano 6.5 millimeter bolt action rifle, like three shots in 8 seconds. Ludicrous. The FBI couldn't even duplicate it. Ludicrous. So you now step back and say, okay, that the media and the government lied to me about who murdered a sitting president. The next question is, who do you think murdered a sitting president? And everybody in the audience says the CIA.
Yeah.
The CIA. Who has the power to pull that off? The CIA. Pause. You're right. Now the next follow-up question is, how the hell is the Central Intelligence Agency murdering a sitting president in broad daylight? That's a military coup, Richie. Then you ask other questions about the you hear from, and I've got these mainstream sources on this, the CIA conducting the CIA pulling mind control experiments on innocent American citizens, dosing them with LSD to figure out to you know how best to mind control a victim. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Why is the CIA grabbing innocent American citizens? That's a war crime. The KGB, the Nazi SS, America's worst enemies, blowing the brains out of a sitting president in broad daylight. America's worst enemies couldn't do that. Crazy. The CIA is doing it.
Johnny, can I just interject there before you finish that point? I've got to interject there. This is fascinating. Netflix is running the Martin Scorsese film at the moment called The Irishman. You may have seen it. A lot of people have seen it. It's De Niro and Pacino and Joe Pesci. And it's based on a book called I Heard You Paint Houses about a genuine gangster called Frank Sheeran, who was known as the Irishman. And he worked for a serious boss, a very, very heavy gangster boss called Russell Bufalino. Now, I read the book in the last week or two. It's written by Charles Brandt and it was published in 2004. Shivers are going down my spine here, Johnny, because you mentioned Oliver Stone's film JFK, Kevin Costner. And amazingly, it starred Joe Pesci playing a man called David Ferry in that film. Now, in the book, I Heard You Paint Houses, Frank Sheeran tells David Brandt back in the early 2000s that his mafia bosses supplied the guns for the assassination of JFK. And it was the CIA. You're absolutely 100% right. But they used the mafia. The mafia played a part in it. They supplied the guns. There was about 7 or 8 different shooters. And I read that book and I'm very sceptical. I read it a second time. And I believe that Frank Sheeran, he's dead now, Frank Sheeran, I believe, was telling the truth when he told Charles Brandt, we were involved in the assassination of JFK and we worked with the CIA, because the same gangsters were also involved in the failed Bay of Pigs invasion. And he talks about that in the book as well. Isn't that astonishing? People won't know that the mafia, organized crime and US intelligence came together and, as you said, pulled off a military coup and murdered the president of the United States like a dog in the streets of Dallas. Amazing. Amazing.
Richie, they never separated. The never. United States government regularly partners with organized crime. Regularly. Yeah. By the way, David Ferry, twice Jesuit trained and a Catholic seminarian and almost priest. And as far as I'm concerned, he left the seminary to go into the CIA as part of an organized agenda. It wasn't a haphazard walk for David Ferry. David Ferry, by the way, was the superior of Lee Oswald in the Civil Air Patrol, and very likely abused him and groomed him. And so this sexual perversion and deviancy was what built the conspiracy there. Hey, J. Edgar Hoover, the cross-dressing homosexual, said there's no such thing as organized crime. That's because they're working hand in hand with the organized criminals. How is it the United States government can give over to the Sinaloa drug cartel 50 caliber sniper rifles, RPGs, machine guns, literal machine guns, fully automatic assault weapons in the Fast and Furious scandal, and claim that this was to trace the weapons to see where they go, and then they lost track, air quotes, lost track of the weapons. So how many people were disciplined? How many people were fired? How many people were prosecuted and imprisoned for giving that insane firepower to this vicious, brutal Sinaloa drug cartel? Oh, wait, zero?
Nobody.
That's the answer. They never stopped working with it. So how is the United States government working arm in arm with organized crime? It's the system. It's the basis of the system. And all those good Italian mafia guys, they get great Roman Catholic funerals when they die.
Don't they? Because, and we're told as well that the mafia is gone. It's been dissolved. It's been fragmented through a succession of RICO trials and all the rest of it. And seizing of assets. The government says we dealt with the mafia because we seized assets from them that they couldn't justify, you know, through receipts and stuff. They did this in Ireland, you know, the Criminal Assets Bureau. They said to mafia bosses, how did you get that big house? Oh, you can't explain it? Well, we take it from you. This is what we were told to believe, but the mafia has never gone away. Let me just remind our listeners, Johnny Cerucci is our guest. JohnnyCerucci.com. It's Gianni Johnny Cerucci, by the way, Iraq War veteran, researcher, journalist and podcaster, but author of books like Secret History, Eaters of Children, Illuminati Unmasked and Romans of Mass Destruction. Now, because we're 24 minutes to the top of the hour, this is going to be difficult for you. Not difficult for you, you're well able for it, but it's a lot to cram in a short space of time. Give somebody a brief overview. I won't be interrupting you, take your time, but a brief overview. Make sense for people, Johnny, why you believe all roads lead to the Vatican, which I, as a boy who was raised as Roman Catholic, believe, well, I used to believe, is a benign place in the world. Vatican City, the Pope lives there. They're all lovely and they're all very good. And they manage the priests and the nuns around the world and they manage the missions and it's all hunky-dory. But it isn't. You think the Vatican plays a central role in the chaos that we witness every day of the week and that I talk about, that you talk about. Why the Vatican? Give us an overview.
Well, Richie, I would have never guessed with that New York City, Brooklyn accent of yours that you were born and raised Roman Catholic.
Yeah.
Me too, brother. Me too. Born and raised Italian Roman Catholic. Lived it for 25 years. Thought the same thing. It was just, there's just a benign old man there in Rome. But you, as you look further back in history, hidden from history, is the fact that Rome has ruled for Rome as a military city-state into a religious empire in 500 AD, never stopped ruling. I love to give as the example the birth of the Anglican Church. And Henry VIII, in the early 1500s, Henry was just obsessed with, as all kings are, with the idea that when he dies, he's going to live on through his progeny, specifically his male heirs. But there was a problem. He was a devout Roman Catholic, and this interbreeding, this incestuous interbreeding between kings and queens in Europe is to promote this ludicrous idea, this feudalism of the divine right of kings to rule over you by their incestuous bloodline. And so he was married to a Spaniard, Catherine of Aragon, and Catherine of Aragon was not giving him his male heir. And so he was beside himself. He wanted the divorce to, and he, who did he go to for permission to get a divorce? The King of England had to go to the Pope of Rome for permission to get, what? This is just an insight into the power of Rome just 500 years ago, 600 years ago. And because Spain and Catherine of Aragon were very important to the papacy, the answer was no. And I'm pretty sure it was a Medici Pope at the time. Well, that did not sit well with Henry, because the only thing more important to Henry than pleasing Rome is to live on in his progeny. And so that's what caused Henry to separate and to create his own miniature Catholic church. He didn't become Protestant. He just created a miniature Catholic church, the Church of England, Anglicanism. The great Protestant preacher John Knox at the time, the fiery Scot John Knox, called them on it. So you didn't break from Rome. You created a miniature Rome here in England. You kept all of the infrastructure. You kept the hierarchy so they'd all answer to you. And you just wrote your own rules so that you can continue to turn over these poor women until they give you a male heir. One of the greatest kings, and crazy enough, the greatest kings to ever serve in England, Edward VI, was born as a result. And that's why he was murdered before he could become an adult, because he was a true Protestant. He was murdered by Rome. But the idea that Rome has this power over sovereigns, that sovereigns, and to this day, so-called democratically elected sovereigns, still receive instructions and permission from Rome. And one of the ways that I've learned that they manipulate people is, how is someone born and raised? Are they born and raised Roman Catholic? Are they close to someone Roman Catholic? Did they marry a Roman Catholic? Did they have a Catholic education? Did they have a Jesuit education? I got to go. There's a whole other show on Jesuits, but let's just say the Jesuits are the shock troops of the Catholic Church. Now, a Catholic or Jesuit education is how the Catholic Church reviews and catalogs. Nobody catalogs better than especially the Jesuits. They influence you in this. You go through a Catholic education, you think it means nothing. And yet, if you don't have something that really takes the place of that Catholic influence, you don't become a passionate Buddhist or a born-again Christian or a really practicing Hasidic Orthodox Jew, where it overtakes. And even then, sometimes those roots of Francis Xavier, one of the co-founders of the Jesuits, said, give me the child until he's seven and I'll give you the man.
Give you the man.
Man, they get their clutches in you. They get their Richie, their clutches in you. And many times it's through sexual abuse. And they control you through that. So I'm seeing this, the Catholic influence. People in prominent positions who are either born and raised Catholic, who married a Catholic, who had a Catholic education or a Jesuit education, who were manipulated by this. And every time I look a little deeper, they're there. Then I'm also seeing a smattering of people who are Jewish, and they still have a Catholic education. And then I'm looking in and realizing that very often I get into this research and I get into this debate with people on whether or not there are lines going to the Vatican, going to Rome, of power above all of this. Who is in control? It's the question in alternative media. Who is really pulling the strings? I know what the government tells me. I know what the media tells me. Who is really pulling the strings? And every time I get close to this idea that it was Rome or the Vatican, someone would jump in and point at Israel or point at the Jews and say, it's the Jews. Well, here's what I found out. Back in 1307 on Friday the 13th, a very important thing happened. The shock troops of the Vatican at that time, the Templars, were suppressed. They were suppressed by the only man in history that I know of to ever put the Vatican under his thumb and not the other way around, Philippe le Bel, Philip IV of France. Actually had the Vatican move to Avignon in France for 70 years. The only king that I know of that had the power to do this. He also suppressed the Templars on unlucky Friday the 13th. Rome learned a valuable lesson from there, because many of the Templars were hunted down by their identities, their names, their faces. They realized we can no longer do our machinations in open public. Oh, by the way, they were suppressed because of usury, sodomy, and sorcery. As a quick aside, who are the real bankers? Jews or Italians? The word bank comes from the Italian banco, which is the counter that the Medici would do their business over. Usury banking was created by the Templars. Created by the Templars. You would have pilgrims. By the way, I'm now, my bias is I'm a born-again Christian. This idea of pilgrimaging, of going on a holy pilgrimage, it's not Christian. It's pagan, but it's Roman Catholic. And so you'd have pilgrims go to the Holy Land, and they would get robbed and set upon. Well, they needed protection. Who provided protection? The Templars did. They would turn their wealth over to a Templar at an armory or a Templar stronghold, and the Templar knight would give them a receipt with a special cipher on it that only another Templar could unencrypt. Well, when you did that, there was also a percentage of your wealth that you left with them. That was the price of the safekeeping of your wealth. That was the birth of usury banking. And this gave the Templars more wealth than many nations in their time. They founded usury banking. So that brought them up to prominence where they were a threat, and Philippe Lebel suppressed them. They went underground. They went to Switzerland. They went to Scotland. They became the Swiss Guard of today. They were the basis of Scottish Rite Freemasonry. But Rome learned that she had to hide behind patsies and proxies. And that's where this anti-Semitism comes in. There absolutely are bad people in prominent positions that happen to be Jewish. They are middlemen. Have you heard the name Jeffrey Epstein?
Yeah, folks, of course. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
A middleman, a pedophile pimp, middleman who was selected to fall. By the way, Tony Blair, good friends with Jeffrey Epstein. Tony Blair, the guy who left office and then decided, you know what? I'm going to become Roman Catholic.
Convert to Catholicism. That's right. He did, yeah.
I'm going to go ahead and convert. You know what? I've always been intrigued by this Catholic thing. I'm going to be out of office, of course. Meanwhile, we got Boris Johnson, the guy who turned London into Londonistan. Born and raised in New York City, as a matter of fact. But an open Roman Catholic. They're now in the open. Prior to this, they had to do it in secret. They had to keep their agents in secret. When America was founded, Catholics weren't even allowed to vote because of the unbelievable power of the Catholic Church, where devout Catholics, there's a scene in the Scorsese movie, was it Gangs of New York City, where Day-Lewis is this caricature of this Protestant cutthroat.
Yeah, Bill the Butcher, I remember it.
Yeah. So the politician says, hey, you see that ship? It's Americans are burning. Americans. And Day-Lewis comes back and says, I don't see Americans. I see, and it was a big thing against the Irish. I see Irish immigrants that here for a bowl of soup, and they're going to vote whichever way the man in the pointy hat in Rome tells them. It's Scorsese, a good Italian Roman Catholic Scorsese's way of putting it. That's why Catholics were not allowed to vote at the founding of the country. Unbelievable power. But it was all under the surface. Now, today, it's out in the open. Out in the open. The EU founded, the whole European Union movement was founded by a Jesuit priest named Joseph Redinger. The Trilateral Commission was founded by devout Roman Catholic Zbigniew Brzezinski. Jimmy Carter's national security advisor, who also created Al Qaeda.
The round table groups. Now, I've got to ask you this. I've got to interject, because you're right to say that. And it's amazing to me that over the years, guests have pointed out to me correctly that look at these guys here, Richie, Jesuits, Catholicism. And I go, yeah, that's interesting. It's more than interesting. It's important. I've got to accept it. But I'm not one of these. I don't have any downer whatsoever on Jewish people or Jews. I make an obvious distinction between Judaism and Zionism. Why then do we see the influence today, the all pervasive influence of Zionism in the UK and in the United States, political Zionism? Why do we see that? What's going on there? Are you telling me that behind that there's some old Catholic or old Jesuit influence? Because it looks very much to me like you see neocon Zionists, you see dual citizen politicians everywhere, you see groups in the UK, Labour Friends of Israel, Conservative Friends of Israel, you see sheer terror in this country, politicians, media refusing to criticise Israel, its behaviour in Gaza, its oppression of the Palestinian people. I see Israel having an unbelievable influence. This little country in the Middle East, what's that about then? What's going on there, do you think?
100% distraction, Richie. All of those examples are absolutely true, but they're enabled and promoted as a distraction. If Jerusalem didn't exist, we would all be looking at Rome. There has always been a plan to resurrect Israel. It was part of an agenda for Napoleon Bonaparte. When the Jesuits were suppressed in 1773, absolute insanity. Devout Roman Catholic nations, nations that would, their sovereigns, the only authority that their sovereigns held above their own was the Pope. And yet you had France, Spain, Portugal, all kicking the Jesuits out in 1773. Are you kidding me? The Jesuits were the ultimate soldiers of Rome. That was orchestrated. It was orchestrated. When the Jesuits left France, where did they go? They went to the island of Corsica, where there was a little boy growing up named Napoleon Bonaparte. Napoleon Bonaparte grew into the emperor that we know. He had a Roman Catholic priest, Abbe Joseph Sias, whispering in his ear, telling him what to do, telling him to go and attack Rome, and then later to force the Pope to reinstitute the Jesuits. But when the Jesuits went underground, and they had the birth of Napoleon Bonaparte, the creation of Napoleon Bonaparte, Emperor Bonaparte, what was it but Napoleon's agenda in 1799 to reconstitute Israel? He actually was unable to do it, but it was part of his agenda. It has always been a very critical Roman agenda to create that as a distraction. Then you go into the Nazi Third Reich, and you start seeing the Roman Catholic influences, such as a Jesuit priest by the name of Heinrich Himmler, a devout Roman Catholic, wealthy Roman Catholic named Franz von Papen, who bankrolled the Third Reich. Then you find out that a Jesuit priest, an anti-Semitic Jesuit priest named Father Bernard Stamfel, actually wrote Mein Kampf for Hitler. Are you kidding me?
And Goebbels was a Jesuit as well, if memory serves. Joseph Goebbels.
Strong Roman Catholic influences. Why would Rome do that? For two reasons. One is to punish the homeland of Martin Luther. And two is to create this atmosphere of pushing Jews into a reconstituted Israel. Once you can reconstitute Israel, the Encyclopedia Judaica says the Rothschilds were nothing more than the keepers of the wealth of the Vatican. The purpose is as a massive distraction. They love it when Israel goes in and commits crimes in Palestine and beats down the Palestinians and creates this divisiveness. But here's the real power, Richie. I see it in America. Here's the real power. Where do you see Jewish names? You see Jewish names in Hollywood. You see Jewish names in music. Do you see Jewish names in the CIA? No. The CIA was founded by devout Roman Catholic Wall Street lawyer William Donovan, Knight of Malta. The FBI was founded by Napoleon's great-grandnephew, Charles Joseph Bonaparte, also devout Roman Catholic. These are the institutions. America's worst. This is why I became the man I am, why I left the military. America's greatest enemies are her own institutions, and at the root of her institutions are Roman Catholic.
Let me ask another question. This is great. So it's great to have somebody on with whom you're challenging me. You're annoying me, Johnny. It's good. You're not annoying me. I'll tell you what I mean by that. Manny Friedman wrote a brilliant article for the Times of Israel. And he said, Jews should stop apologising for controlling the media. We do, he said, and we've had a great laugh over the years talking about this. So what's going on then? Where are the Jews then? Because if the Jews control the media, and I shouldn't say the Jews, because Jewish people, they live amongst us and they don't control anything. They're not in control of their mortgage, they're not in control of their own houses. But this Zionism, this control of the media, where's the opposition then to this hegemony of Jesuit and Catholic influences? What the bloody hell are the Jews doing about it? What's going on is what I'm asking. Where's the opposition to it?
Oh, they've got it. They've got to keep it underground. I've got a list of names I'm going to give you real quick. They've got to. Let's see here. Media manipulators. We'll tell you some of the names of the real manipulators of media. They want you to see the names, the Jewish names in media, but they don't want you to see names like Conrad Black in Canada, Canadian billionaire, media billionaire, Knight of St. Gregory, Knight of the Holy See, Claire Booth Luce and Henry Luce, Knight of Malta, Dame of Malta, Gustavo Cisneros, Venezuela, Roman Catholic media mogul, billionaire, Sir Eugene John Paul Getty, of the Getty family, Roman Catholic, copywriting all those pictures before you can get an opportunity to get on. William Randolph Hearst, Knight of Malta. Leo Kirsch in Germany, media mogul. Then you've got these guys like Bob Guccione, who grew up Italian Roman Catholic, wanted to be a priest and became a pornographer instead. Then you've got media managers like, Stephen Kevin Bannon. Stephen Kevin Bannon, who also managed Donald Trump's campaign for president. Stephen Kevin Bannon went to Benedictine College Prep and master's from Georgetown's Edmund Wall School of Foreign Service.
Yeah, but let me argue with you again, Johnny. Let me argue with you again. The likes of Bannon and Trump, they're Zionist wet dream, Johnny. Trump has just announced in the last couple of hours his plan for a two-state solution, which is basically giving the middle finger to the Palestinians, giving Jerusalem to Israel. So on the one hand, I'm getting you, and you're challenging my thinking on this, and you're making a very compelling case, which I knew you would do. But on the other hand, I see these guys that you're mentioning. It looks like, to all intents and purposes, they continue to just bend over backwards for Zionism.
Where did Bannon go in 2014 as he's ramping up for the campaign? He didn't go to Jerusalem, Richie. He went to Rome to have an audience with the Pope. Donald Trump is a clown. Have you seen the video of Trump with his lawyer Rudy Giuliani dressed in drag, where he shoves his face into Rudy's fake breasts?
Yeah.
Have you seen the video of Donald Trump at WrestleMania where he cuts Roman Catholic Vince McMahon's hair for him? He's an absolute clown. It sickens me that my mother's got a picture of him on her refrigerator. She's a good Italian Roman Catholic woman. She doesn't know any better. The guy, I can't understand how people take this clown seriously. The only thing is he's better off the cuff. He's more funny off the cuff than poor Barack Obama. Barack Obama had a family of CIA family. He was traumatized by being abused as a little boy by black communist Frank Marshall Davis in the heart of Roman Catholic Chicago.
Now, I know, hang on now, because I know this is suspected, but I'm going to give you some shit here. How do you know for a fact that Obama was abused by this guy? I know he spent time with this guy. You're absolutely right. And I know that you're not alone in believing that Obama was controlled through sexual abuse. But how do you know that? Where's the empirical evidence to support?
Well, good for you. Good for you. There is nothing...
Hope he's not gone. He's still there, Johnny. Sounds like it's all kicked off over at Johnny's. Are you still there, my friend? Right. Let me just disconnect from Johnny. We're running out of time anyway. And reconnect with him very quickly. Because I've heard this before about Obama, but there's no proof that Obama was abused, you know? At least none that I've seen, anyway. But fair play to him. He's answering the questions. Johnny Cerucci is live on the Richie Allen Radio Show. And I'm trying to reconnect with him. I think something has happened there. You're back!
Yeah, my electricity went out.
Ah, your electricity went off and on. Ah, there you are. I thought you then got tired of... I'm fed up. I've got better things to do than speak to the BBG. I thought you just left the room. No, I didn't really. Listen, we've only got about 90 seconds left. Now, bear with me. This is going to kill my listeners that we're going to leave it here. But we are, because less is more, and it's good to tease people. I'm asking you to come back in 2 weeks from today to do part two of this, where we'll get into it in more detail. We'll do 90 minutes with your permission, because I love it, and it's of huge interest to my audience. I think it's the right way to go about it. We'll leave them hanging. But just finish off the Obama answer. Why you believe...
Real quick.
Go ahead.
Yes, absolutely. Real quick. And in between then and now, I've got an interview with Greta Thunberg. I'm going to become a chauffeur for her in her carbon-free Mercedes.
No way. But, are you taking the piss or are you serious? You're not serious. You're taking the piss. Yeah, yeah. Jeez, I don't know. The world is mad. You might have been telling the truth. Go ahead.
Richie, God bless you. You're spot on. I do not have, it's one of the few times somebody called me on it and I don't have the names, places, and dates that I can throw out. What I can throw out is I have a Roman Catholic reporter named Jack Casho who pulled up a poem by Barack Obama that implies Obama was abused. And so they have made this deduction that there was abuse through this connection. Now, people know that there is a connection between Frank Marshall Davis and Barack Obama. People have made the accusation that there might even be some familiar resemblance there. So, yes, that is a deduction for me that I don't have actual proof of. But I do know for a fact that the Central Intelligence Agency uses sex abuse and trauma for manipulation. Trauma, especially sexual abuse trauma, was integral. Now it's more technology-based, was integral in so-called mind control. It's one of the reasons why you see guys like Tiger Woods, who is just this child prodigy, having this sexual orgy meltdown. That those are evidences that he was abused, he was submitted to this sexual trauma as a child as part of this mind control training.
Maybe, but also maybe he's just a wealthy guy with lots of money and believes that he's above the law and that he can do whatever he wants. But I hear you. Listen, we're going to stop right here. I know you won't be offended by that. We've had a brilliant chat for the last 50 minutes or thereabouts. I can't not mention before we go, and we are going to come back in a couple of weeks and we'll do a 90-minute stint, because I've had dozens and dozens of tweets while we've been speaking, and I haven't even gotten to them because I was so enraptured by what you were saying, I didn't want to interrupt you. So here we go. To find out more about Johnny, if you haven't come across him before, go to johnnycerucci.com. I will put a link out to it on Twitter. Iraq war veteran, former army officer, the author of Secret History, Eaters of Children, Illuminati Unmasked, and his latest book, Romans of Mass Destruction. Links to those books on Johnny's website. He's got a podcast as well, which is hugely popular. It's called Resistance Rising. I've loved having you on. I'm up for 2 weeks from today, getting back into it again. If that doesn't work, we can do the previous day or the Wednesday. Thanks for your time, Johnny. You've made the show today. I really appreciate it. Final word to you.
Love you, Rich. I'm really excited to finally be interviewed by the BBG and looking forward to doing more of it. As much as you want me, I'll be back, brother. I'm your servant.
You're a gentleman, Johnny. Thanks for coming on today, live from Philadelphia. You've been listening to Johnny Cerucci on the Richie Allen Radio Show. Massive thanks to Johnny for coming on, and to Pippa King, whom you heard in the first hour. I've got to get out of here now to get this on turnaround, because I got a lot of stick yesterday from listeners because it wasn't playing every 2 hours on the air as it should do. Johnny will be back on to pick up this conversation again in a couple of weeks, leaving you with the Cranberries and Dreams. Thanks, Pippa. Thanks, Johnny. Thanks to you for listening. Back again tomorrow morning at 9:30, YouTube, for the nonsense that is the Paper Review Show. Bye now.